This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 17th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 189, with me, Robert Bounds, and Sophie Grove.
On the show today, we'll be passengers on a trip to the East, courtesy of author and academic Amit Chowdhury, whose new book tells the story of his home city, Calcutta.
We'll be attempting to sound as on it as possible while learning about street art's ascent from gutter to the gallery. That's Banksy, right, Sophie?
Yes, that's exactly right, Rob. Keeping things a little bit more in the here and now, we'll also be meeting curator Kathy Haynes to discuss the none-too-brief topic of time itself. She'll be telling us about how objects around us reflect the times we live in.
That is all to come, plus we'll take a look at next week's news with Tom Edwards and enjoy a song or two right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome, everybody, to the Monocle Weekly, episode 189. Just from the menu, that you know the thing I'm looking forward to most?
Time.
Yeah, time. I'm wanting to sing a bit of the Stones, or like maybe we should play in some Pink Floyd or something.
I'd like to recite some Shakespearean, you know, sonnets, maybe a few couplets.
Shall I compare thee to a...
Well, it's more like, you know, the sort of... the ragged image of old Father Time I'm bringing
is that you're
into
just saying that because you're looking
now.
At me right?
So the kind of idea of the reaper not it's nothing to do with your wonderful beatific face.
There's an icy atmosphere between Sophie and I from the off this week. It's going to be a classic show, ladies and gentlemen. I know I've started turning the face on my watch around so I don't know what time it is when it gets that late at night. It's fine. That's a little tip. Exactly. But it's good. I kind of feel like it's been one of those weeks where time is a good topic of discussion, because it's been a strange week where it's been kind of, I felt kind of weirdly like it should have been the summertime. I'm kind of feeling like winter should have been over. I feel strange. I feel like I've been transported to a number of different places. I've been to see lots of films this week and kind of like sort of been out and about a lot. I kind of feel like I don't know whether I'm foot or on horseback.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Well, I've been sort of really more or less an editing marathon this week.
You've been making not a serious face, but a workmanlike face at your desk for quite a lot of this week, I'd
exactly.
suggest.
Well, I think so. And also, I think that we really are toughing it out in London for winter, which on the subject of time is actually quite interesting, because it means that you're really going to get the benefit of the spring when it comes. We're all yearning for it. If you stay in London all winter, believe me, it's worth it when you see those crocuses poking through.
And yeah, exactly. When those daffs are kind of like peeping their heads out from through that thickening grass, we'll feel like it's kind of absolute balm, right?
We will. We're sticking by the homestead, and other people are sort of flitting around the globe, but they won't. Yeah, we're sort of.
You're not going to mention any names, are you?
We're digging in for winter.
Not going to mention any names. Let's not say that. we need to know which side our bread's buttered.
We do.
So we basically, what we're saying is, we deserve a couple of medals. I don't mind. I don't need maybe I'd have a star. I don't know whether you favour a general normal round medal, but we need a couple of medals.
We do, yeah.
For sticking it out.
And a ceremony in spring.
All right, well, we're going to kick the show off and we're just biding our time until the time chat. But coming up first of all, we're going to be welcoming Tom Edwards in for his news look ahead.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Oh, man. We can never tire of that. Tom, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Sophie. How are you both?
Terrific.
Fine, thanks. Good. Right, what's in your news? What have you got? What is it, a filing cabinet? How have you brought it in this week?
It's just amongst a sheaf of papers.
Okay, in your inside pocket.
That's right. I'm going to start with something fairly serious, and I'm going to gradually become less serious as the week goes on.
Can you draw me a graph of that?
It's pretty straightforward. Okay. I'll work on it. I'll work on it during the item, and I'll show you at the end. And you can see whether you think it reflected. Let's start with tomorrow. This is, we're going to Turkey, the resumption of the trial of Faisal Say. This is the illustrious Turkish pianist. Now, he was charged with inciting hatred and insulting the values of Islam. This is quite serious. Back in October, his trial resumes tomorrow. Eminent pianist. Played with the New York Philharmonic, Berlin Symphony Orchestra, amongst others. And he was accused of mocking radical Islam.
on the piano?
Well, sadly not. He didn't do a sort of musical number. It was mainly his sort of peripheral tweeting that he was doing.
Right.
And so he's in a spot of bother. And I just think it's quite interesting because...
So he's been tried. It's his trials moment.
It's resuming. There's been this long hiatus. And it's just very interesting to look because controls in terms of freedom of speech, the freedom of the media in Turkey is... You know, it's very controversial. A huge number of journalists, for example, who are imprisoned currently. And obviously Turkey's trying to manoeuvre itself back into the sort of political mainstream to engage with Europe. And it'll be interesting to see whether the treatment of Faisal Say reflects, you know, any shifts in the
sort of
attitude.
Test case for joining the Euro and all of the other stuff.
Very
and
much
being
so.
a barometer for the region and stuff as well. That's good. So that was serious. We're at the top of the graph. We're at the beginning of the graph. Where are we going? We're going down or up?
Well, I'd say we're getting up on the levity
index.
But this is still fairly serious. So more general strikes. One in Greece.
Ooh.
That's on Wednesday. But then I'm more intrigued by this. So Greece's main union, the General Confederation of Greek Workers, is holding a 24-hour general strike. We've seen those before. There's normally quite a lot of animus on the streets of Athens. One to watch. I'm more intrigued by this one. The same day...
I don't want to sound like Jeremy Clarkson, but do you think anyone will notice if there's a strike in Greece?
Oh, dear. That is Clarkson-esque, isn't it?
Come on. That's
okay. The same day. How about this one? Lebanese bakery strike. No takers.
I would say that could have a serious impact in Lebanon. They love their delicious bready snacks.
baked goods.
Baked
big
goods.
Business in
big
Beirut.
Deal.
Lots of these
exactly.
there. They could go on strike. There's a government decision to not to change the quantities of subsidised wheat flour available. Mm. And it's pushing them to the very brink.
God.
So we could see
industrial action. So strikes throughout Europe. Will Monocle 24 be picking up on this in our 4 daily news shows?
Oh, you better believe we will. We'll be all over it.
Okay, good. Well, I hope we'll be going to Beirut to speak to maybe a baker who's crossed the picket line.
It could be. A scab.
And he's got a couple of buns on him.
We might be doing that. Who knows?
Yeah.
Don't give away all my best material for the week ahead.
I'm just saying, that's a features idea. I don't have to come to the meeting now.
It doesn't work like this, Rob, as well you know. Now, let's rapidly move on. On Friday... This is slightly less serious still. The World Ocean Summit. In fact, you could argue this is more serious.
Is this what David Miliband's doing?
Is it what he's doing?
I don't know. Let's not muddy the waters.
I think he may be chairing it.
Yeah.
It's taking place in Singapore on the island resort of Sentosa. I've been there. Just coincidentally.
Okay, what's it like?
That in there. I went there on a cable car.
You went there on a recce for this item.
Yeah. I was just laying the groundwork.
That's how thorough
but
you are, Tom.
This is quite a big deal. I like to cover all the bases. This is to look at the sustainable management of activities in and around the ocean. Critically important.
So what is this about managing? Is this about managing fish stocks? Is this about
fish stocks?
Making sure people behave themselves with coral.
Trades routes, coral, whether people behave themselves with it. Guilty.
I mean,
what have you got to confess to me? What have
I've
you
got
been
an
doing?
Anemone in my back pocket. So I can't sit down properly.
And then finally, I just want to end on a slightly higher note. It's been awards season, particularly in the movies. You hear about these all the time, you know, the Golden Globes, the Oscars imminently. The Razzies next Saturday. One I really
this is
like.
Porn.
This is for the worst movies, the worst performances. And it's quite interesting because sometimes the actors actually turn up to claim the worst actor gong.
That's brilliant. Who's nominated? What are we looking at?
Well, apparently the Twilight saga is... Once again, dominating all categories.
Here.
Which you can read plenty into that.
It's quite fun, though, because I imagine that Ben Affleck could have been nominated for a Razzie in the past, and now he's, you know, no longer on the Razzie list. He's gathering, you know, awards right, left and centre.
It can happen even quicker than that. In 2010, Sandra Bullock actually turned up at the Razzies to claim her award worst actress. One day later, she won the Best Actress Oscar.
Lord. That's not amazing. For the same performance.
Sadly not.
That would have been absolutely superb.
But for her performance in The Blind Side, I don't know if you saw that picture, she won the Oscar, but she got the Razzie for All About Steve.
Oh dear.
Sounds
bad.
Terrible,
All About Steve.
And it clearly was as bad as it sounds. But that's on that's next Saturday night, so tune in.
That's really good. That's 4 great news items, Tom. Thank you very much for doing that.
Pleasure as always.
We kind of got over our little fit of giggles at the beginning, and now I don't feel like I need to pick up a newspaper for a week. I'm filled in.
Perfect. That's if I've done that, I feel complete in myself.
You've stopped me from reading.
Exactly.
My job here is done.
Mission accomplished.
All right, Tom, thank you very much. We'll see you same time next week. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking to Amit Chowdhury about his history of Calcutta. On the banks of the Hooghly River near India's eastern border with Bangladesh lies the city of Calcutta. Although the area's history has been unfolding for millennia, it's relatively recently, within the past 500 years, that Calcutta's densely populated streets have become a hub for culture, trade and political upheaval that we're now familiar with. In 2011, the city's continuing evolution saw it end 30 years of Communist Party-led government, and it's this period that our first guest, author, academic and celebrated musician Amit Chowdhury, knows so well.
Born in Calcutta in 1963, his upbringing both in that city and here in London means he's well placed to cast a knowing yet objective eye over the region's history. His new book, Calcutta, does just that, and he's here to tell us more about it. Amit, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
So can we start with looking at Calcutta's image and history? I mean, it's such a it did have a low point in the 1980s, really, where it became sort of synonymous with poverty. It eclipsed really what it was known best for before that, which is, you know, literature and art. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, the sort of early history of Calcutta?
Sure. Calcutta is not a very old city, though it has kind of accumulated history very quickly and seems sort of older than it is. I mean, it gathered pedigree and history in a matter of, what, 300 years or so. By the middle of the 18th century, it had become the capital of this new India, which was quite different from the new India that is mentioned today, the India of globalization, but it was also an India of an increasingly internationalizing world, but because of colonialism. So it became a capital of this new India under the East India Company and continued to be the capital until 1911, when it stopped being a capital, because largely because of its kind of politics, because of the rise of nationalism, and especially a more kind of agitational and confrontational form of nationalism than would be pursued by Gandhi. Now, in this period between, let's say, the early 19th century to the 1970s, there was this great cultural sort of, it was a great cultural period, beginning with this efflorescence in the middle of the 19th century, where kind of a whole new secular liberal ethos emerges. Firstly, in the early 19th century, to do with the first social reforms against kind of traditional orthodoxies in religion, to do with caste, to do with widows, widow remarriage, all of that. That's where it begins. But at the same time, philosophical reforms are going on towards creating this new, modern, secular Indian, which we take for granted today. And, you know, in the midst of that, there's huge amounts of writing, beginning with people like Tagore, poetry, filmmaking later on, Satyajit Ray, but many others. I'm only mentioning a few names that would be known in the West. Later on, musicians like Ravi Shankar, whose father was a British-trained barrister. So you can see the kind of journeys being made, typical middle-class journeys where fathers might be, you know, bastions of the bourgeoisie, and the children become, in the manner of Thomas Mann narratives, artists and dreamers, and this is what happens with both Tagore and with Ravi Shankar. Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winning economist in the sciences, Satyen Bose, after whom the boson is named, and who created, you know, the Bose-Einstein statistics on which the transition to quantum mechanics in physics has been made possible. All that happened.
We've got to ask you another question here, because we're already getting a sense of the amazing sprawl.
It is
of this
amazing.
Place.
It is completely amazing.
And how do you start to try to define that? Maybe it's more difficult to try to define this sprawl, or at least a section of that sprawl, in a work of non-fiction as opposed to fiction.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's probably possible to define it in non-fiction, but it wasn't my project to talk about what happened, although I couldn't avoid talking about it. And also the fact that as an outsider who was born in Calcutta but had grown up in Bombay, the fact that I was moved by my discovery of this culture, but also moved and instructed by my continual discovery of the ignorance about this culture, and even within the culture, the way people had turned against it. People who took it to be their own history had then gone on to become Marxists by the 70s, and that's when the Marxist government came into power, and they did their best to level out the kind of inheritance, the institutional kind of remnants of this history in terms of the great colleges, because they saw them as elite institutions. But the first time that what happened in the 19th century and after was, the first time it was called the Bengal Renaissance, was by actually a Marxist scholar, Bengali Marxist scholar in the 40s. And then the Marxists themselves said, how on earth can you call this, how can you compare this to the Italian Renaissance? Because of this whole kind of colonial mindset of self-loathing to a certain extent, that, you know, we couldn't possibly have had a genuine Renaissance, but something amazing actually had happened. You were talking about the image of Calcutta, especially in the 80s. Now, outside of Calcutta, for a long time, Calcutta was acknowledged as a cultural hub, even if people didn't know actually what was going on over there. So, you know, this great Maharashtrian politician from Bombay could say that what Bengal thinks today, India does tomorrow. And that has become the butt of much satire now, because of what India thinks today, Bengal doesn't do at all, never does. But that's what the image of Calcutta was in India. Now, outside of India, especially in the 80s, when I was living in England as an undergraduate, I realized that this kind of multifarious city of modernity, with all its exacerbations and extremities to do with great culture, historical trauma, in which it can be compared with many other cities like New York and Berlin and Rome after the war, cities in which there have been historical trauma causing exacerbations and poverty, but also a great cultural vibrancy. I mean, all this had been swallowed up by the figure of Mother Teresa and this idea of charity and the poor. What was interesting is how a city as important as this, in terms of our understanding of modernity in the world, and certainly modernity in Asia and in India, got completely erased by this new story, which is in a way kind of built up as well by, you know, market forces, because it just seemed the easiest thing for television and magazines.
And how those market forces, which are so famous and have been so famous in India since deregulation in the last 15 years, does that stop people being reflective? Does that stop people in Calcutta being reflective about their past if they're always focusing on the future and on cash rather than perhaps looking around them at the tapestry that surrounds them?
What's happened to Calcutta, but this is before economic deregulation, what happened to it was radical sort of left-wing politics took charge of what was going on in the city, or tried to take charge. And when there was a general left-oriented radicalization of politics the world over in the late 60s, it took a particularly kind of radical turn in Calcutta. So you had Maoists called Naxals who tried to effect a kind of Bolshevik-style revolution. The upshot of that was industry and the middle class began to leave Calcutta, and that has been leaving Calcutta ever since. Then in 1977, the left-wing Marxist government took over and stayed in power for 34 years. They did many good things to begin with, to do with kind of redistributing landlord-owned land among sharecroppers, but also sort of consolidating a secular environment and ethos in Bengal. It still is in many ways the most secular of the Indian cities, or maybe the world cities, in that right-wing groups haven't had much success historically in post-independence in Calcutta and Bengal. Right now, the middle class is at a place where they're thinking, when will we take part in this great story of the India boom? Because
they feel that they're left behind. They feel they're reading about it in their newspapers. It's happening around them, but not there.
So they feel like to succeed, we have to go to New Jersey or we have to go to Bangalore.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
That's what they're feeling like. This doesn't mean that they don't have some sort of a regard for their cultural past, but that regard is a very static sort of regard. It kitschifies that past. It's a utopian kind of version of that past. So you hear kind of digital Muzak versions of Tagore songs in restaurants that serve Bengali cuisine. That's what that past has been transformed into.
It's a strange idea for a city like Calcutta to orientalize its own history. Yeah.
But orientalizing its own history is a big project in India anyway. I mean, Bollywood is full of orientalist versions of its own history.
I wondered, I mean, you describe Calcutta very vividly in the book, and it's such a beautiful place, and it does have a colonial architecture fabric. Do you think that it in the future that is going to allow it to kind of release its potential. I mean, it may have been neglected horribly, but you know, going forward, Calcutta, it is a potentially, you know, it's a garden city. There's a zoo and a wonderful library, and it has so much potential.
It absolutely has a lot of potential, and architecturally it's very diverse. So there is the great colonial architecture kind of embodied by the colonial buildings, the general post office, etc. Some of it has been destroyed, but a lot of it is still there. But then in the north, there are the kind of old aristocratic houses built by Erivist kind of landowners who realize Calcutta is the hub and we want to move here and we want to sort of, you know, do things here. And they build these mansions with courtyards, and they are magnificent. And then in South Calcutta, where middle class and upper middle class people lived, there are these amazing mutations of European style houses, the red stone floors, slatted French windows, and verandas arising out of the bungalow, which is, as a word itself, comes from Bangla, which comes from Bangla, which is Bengali, you know. So you have all these kind of styles of architecture, because I think if Calcutta is going to have a future, then it must engage with its past, but not nostalgically, not in this kitschifying utopian way. And I think that these buildings are going to be part of its future, just as I think that the other city that I think of, which was marginalized by history many times over, is Berlin. But the way it's kept bouncing back and making use of its spaces which were no longer in use or had fallen out of use. Like if you think of post-war Berlin or post-unification Berlin and what they did with Prenzlauer Berg or in East Berlin after unification, all those were unviable spaces. Now, Calcutta wants to escape those unviable spaces, either physically with the middle class moving to New Jersey or to Bangalore, or they want to destroy the buildings and build shopping malls there, even as they mourn the passing of those buildings. But those terrific kind of heterogeneity, variety in Calcutta. And it is potentially very beautiful, not in a static way, but in a living way. I had to kind of trace that labyrinth, as you put it. Then chapter by chapter, you know, separated those journeys into, let's say, a chapter about buying discarded windows from a house that had been destroyed, and another chapter about Christmas on Park Street, a place that I thought I knew but which I didn't. I found out once I began to interview the homeless on the street, and other such chapters. And then the titles came right at the end.
We're going to have to leave it there. Like the book acts presumably as a thread through that labyrinth. For the time being, Amit Chowdhury, author of Calcutta, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle Briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
We'll be hearing about street art next, but first, some music. This is some new pastoral folky prettiness from Iceland. It's German Fields by Olaf Arnolds.
Olaf Arnolds' new one, that's German Fields, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Sophie Grove. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Street art, those rough and ready works you should be able to find in any slightly neglected, and sometimes all too knowingly so, corner of your favourite city, is no longer merely the bookish cousin of graffiti. It's now a big business.
In the past few years, the bold and recognisable style of street art has made its way to LA's Mocha, Britain's Tate, and almost every art fair on the global map, drawing in big-budget collectors and speculative buyers.
Monocle's Jack Phillips recently looked into London's urban art scene through the eyes of a gallerist, a collector, and an artist to get a sense of the bigger picture.
The Pure Evil Gallery in London's East End is a small but important space. Owner Charles Edwards, aka Pure Evil, has been making and selling street art for over two decades. His work is in demand, the artists he represents too, and he has made a successful international business as a result.
Came back from California about 10 years ago, inspired by a lot of the West Coast graffiti that I'd seen. And then when I got back here, I was bombarded with all of the street art that was starting to go up in this area. So I became a bit of a late night stencil artist, going out and kind of spray painting stuff. 5 years ago, I started this gallery kind of accidentally as a way of exhibiting my own work for 2 weeks. And then after 2 weeks, it became 3 months, and then four, five, six, became a year. And so far, 5 years down the line, we've done about 50 different shows with different street artists and graffiti artists. But it's like a blotting paper effect. It's been sort of dropped in the centre of London, and it's kind of spread out. And, you know, there are strongholds like in Barcelona or in Sao Paulo or in Los Angeles. But because of the internet, it's meant that there is this kind of global city, which is just everywhere. You know, if someone like Roa, who paints beautiful animals, has done a piece in Mexico City, people will know about it everywhere else around the world.
Andrew Lilly is a private collector of street art based in Ireland. Originally, his collection housed Lichtensteins, Scullys and Warhols. Now it boasts largely original and commissioned works by street artists all over the world. For him, their appeal is obvious.
The way I look at it is, a lot of the messages are international. A lot of the messages that are up on the walls or on the artwork or whatever, you know, the likes of the Cranio, you know, it's a small figurine in a Brazil shirt with the World Cup giving the finger. I mean, you could put that anywhere in the world and people would instantly recognize it. It's international, pure evil in his nightmare scenarios. Sick Boy and Ray, they have their influences from Picasso and Basquiat and Herring, and no matter where you are in the world, those same images reoccur. It's a common theme, I think, a common denominator in street art, where it doesn't necessarily exclude itself to one area or one type of socialization. It's international.
But how does often social and politically motivated artwork export? Do its ideals translate, or are they just lost in the crossover?
And there is that sort of dilution effect of when you take, you know, artwork and street art off the street and graffiti off the street, that it just isn't street art anymore. It isn't graffiti art. It becomes an art, just art. You know, there are people who don't give a monkey's about, you know, the sort of what Banksy's trying to say about society. All they really care about is getting five of their mates to queue up outside when there's a new Banksy release so that his mates can give him all of the prints and then he can flip them on eBay. So there's definitely people who have, you know, sort of seen a way to make money out of this. You know, I'd probably include myself in that. I'm able to pay my rent and, you know, hang out in Shoreditch listening to nice music on the radio and paint because of the popularity of street art.
The prolific rise in the demand for street and street-styled art is clear, but who should potential collectors be looking out for at the galleries and auction houses?
Ranges from the likes of Sick Boy, Pure Evil, Catherine Friedrich, Mobster, more recently the likes of Ray from Brooklyn, the States, Cranio from South America, from Brazil, Invader from France. There's also Adam Neat, again from UK, so there's a wide-ranging.
Graffiti artist Parlay is a former member of British street art crew, the Essex Rockers, a group which garnered notoriety back in the early 90s. Having laid down his can for over a decade, he has recently begun making artwork again, in part due to this market demand for street style.
Six months ago, I was painting by the bins outside by my flat, and that's where I had to make my art. I put some stuff up on Facebook, and Facebook, obviously the internet and the social networking, you get a lot of people following you. And as it happened, one of those people that was following me turned out to be the director of the Opera Gallery on Bond Street, and he saw a wall I did from my dad. I got an email off him saying, will you do that on a canvas for me, bring it in. I've actually got three pieces at this moment winging their way over to Dallas, which is kind of insane. I got picked up by an amazing guy, and he ended up buying quite a lot of work off me. And now my work is hanging next to a Murakami in one room, a Rothko in another room, and that's just insane. But these people seem to see my stuff as a bit of an investment and an opportunity to take hold of someone that's just getting started.
Straight-talking text and bold colours have become a globally commodified aesthetic and instantly recognisable as a fashionable genre of art to own. But there is also scope to turn a profit on an investment as institutions open their doors to subculture.
Paris is a good market because I think they've always been in love with graffiti, maybe even so more than in the UK. They've had a longer kind of love affair with it. it's reflected in when you have auctions in Paris, it's more about graffiti artists and the history of graffiti leading up from, you know, sort of Tacky and other artists who were kind of the originators of the graffiti movement. Whereas in the UK, when you look at the auctions, it's more about there's this guy called Banksy, and then there's a whole bunch of other guys that are a bit like him. I mean, places like China, they're just kind of growing up to the fact that, you know, waking up to the fact that, you know, this is an interesting kind of new art form. That the contemporary art world has always been this sort of ivory tower that's, you know, it's sort of its own thing, and you're not really invited to it. You're allowed to go there and go, ooh, that's great.
The fifth is already in the room.
You go into the major galleries now to get them. With regards to auction houses, again, it used to be the sort of the smaller auction houses, but now you have, you know, the likes of Bonhams, who have an urban art show, you know, a couple of times a year. You go over to Paris, and Art Curio, and any of the major auction houses in France and even Germany, as I said, they will represent street art, and they will also tie it in, not just to street art auctions. Some of the street artists now are actually falling into contemporary art auctions with the likes of Banksy, Adam Neaton, and et cetera, et cetera.
Street art is becoming increasingly popular among art collectors. Established gallerists are housing special shows, and the demand seems to cross borders as emerging markets look set to snap up new talent, increased further by the spread of social media. Tag names have replaced real ones, and although the return on investment is yet to be realised, for now prices are soaring and the list of names to own is growing, as Andrew and Pure Evil explain.
And the ones that cross the boundary into the contemporary market, they are being bought up by the larger galleries, the larger institutions, and certainly I know of some up-and-coming artists that are being snapped up, whole entire collections are being snapped up by other European countries, like Italy and France, on the basis that I suppose they're all hoping for the next Banksy.
There's a big market for street art now. There's a lot of auction houses. There are a lot of collectors, there are a lot of dealers who were, you know, maybe they, you know, now the excitement is being able to buy a Banksy for 400 quid and flip it for 3 grand. Or, you know, finding new artists. So the, you know, the old sort of fashion dealer has now become, you know, the new fashion dealer who's kind of seeing this as a commodity. They found an underground culture, they found a way to flip it and make money out of it.
And that was Jack Phillips in London.
Up next, we'll be meeting curator Kathy Haynes.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
London's Petrie Museum houses over 80,000 historical artefacts, ranging from ancient Egyptian finds to Sudanese archaeological treasures. This year, it's been calling on the talents of artist and curator Kathy Haynes, who's resident timekeeper for the collection.
Haynes is no stranger to uniting themes out of huge topics, having also helped shape Transport for London's Art on the Underground project. She's here now to tell us a little bit about how objects that surround us are not only shaped by time, but also reflect the times we live in. Kathy, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Lovely to see you. Yes, objects and all of the objects in the Petrie, fascinating as they are, do they really pertain to the concept of time, which is immaterial?
Yes, and well, this is a great question, because whenever we talk or think about time, we can't help but imagine it visually. We sort of spatialise it in our heads, but of course, time, as soon as you try and fix it into space, is no longer time. So a time map, for example, contains no time, like a static drawing of a timeline or a planner grid. It contains no time. And the philosopher Henri Bergson and lots of other people have reminded us that we shouldn't be mistaking are tools of time for time itself. And if we start mistaking those tools for time itself, then we actually start to become blinded to aspects of our experience and to reality. And so this project at the Petrie is, the Petrie is such an exciting museum because of these objects which go back thousands and thousands of years. So there are, for example, there's a 5,000-year-old child's shirt with gorgeous, you can see the creasing and the sewing in it. And there's a really deep sense of time that you get when you enter the museum. And that sense that, you know, that the person has just taken that shirt off. There's a kind of an imminence to the past in that place. It's amazing. But it's not that particular aspect of time in objects that I'm looking at. I'm mainly looking at the kind of objects that are explicitly designed to shape our experience of time. And at the Petrie, you get all sorts of different kinds, and they're often not models of time that we necessarily can recognise or understand. But
so they're models of time dependent upon what century we live in or what part of the world we live in?
Yeah. Our sense of what time is, how we conceive it, of it, how we experience it maybe, are influenced by, the culture that we grow up in. And different cultures have different models of time.
And I love the idea you started off talking about, that as soon as we invent an object that tells the time or that keeps the time within it or tries to, then that, it just becomes an object and it still ceases to define time. How did you choose what's going to be in this show if it's about objects? It's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is right at the beginning, so we're just opening out. It's an open, creative project that we're exploring with the help of people from lots of different fields. So this is just the beginning. But what I'm doing is collecting those sorts of objects that seek to define our time and drawing connections between them. So they're kind of like fragments that don't beat to the same clock. They don't even beat to a clock often, that give us a contrasting experience of time. And an example might be in the Petrie collection, there's a shadow clock. And for a period of ancient Egyptian civilization, a shadow clock meant that you experienced the hour in a longer unit in the summer than you would in the winter. So there would be 12 hours a day of daylight, but that hour would fluctuate. The sort of standard length of that hour would fluctuate depending on the time of year. And then later on you get a water clock, which defines the hour by an exact standard and an exact unit, much closer to how we would imagine it. But how the ancient Egyptians understood what drives history, what causes history, what the relationship between past and present is, or between eternity and now, or between the dead and the living, is totally different from ours.
Is there a way of discerning how people felt about time before everyone had a wristwatch and before maps and timelines became something that are on the internet and are on every single person's like mobile device? Did people think differently about time 200 years ago, for example?
Maybe, and this is a really fascinating question. So there's an analysis by a guy called Eric Auerbach in a book called Mimesis of why, you know, when you look at a Caravaggio painting of, say, Christ, and everyone looks like contemporaneous with Caravaggio, everyone looks like a sort of Renaissance peasant, and that looks like a clever device. It looks like it's telling you, hey, look, Christ is just like us. But actually, Auerbach says that for Caravaggio, that wouldn't have necessarily been a clever device because he wouldn't have had the same sense of radical separation between past and present that we have. That he would have sensed a sense of connection, a divine connection with those, with Christ through the sacred, through the divine. And there's a different sense of what's driving history as well for, say, the medieval mind. The sense is that the divine there's a divine plan, that God has preordained what is going to happen. So the sacrifice of Christ is preordained by the sacrifice of Isaac and so on. So history is already plotted out, and what you've got to do is look for the signs of the times, and then you can work out what's coming in the future. For us, we have a sense that we can make history, that humans drive history. And that happens in a very strong way. That sense of us being the drivers of history happens with the Renaissance, but really kicks in about 250 years ago. And one of the things I'm most interested in are the kind of graphic or infographics, as we would call them now, that really gave that idea credibility.
I wondered if there's a human urge to record time and to sort of categorise this idea of moving forward. Even if you're, you know, on a desert island, you might want to sort of notch the days. Mm. Do you think that that's innate in us, or do you think that that's something that's, you know, imposed upon us by, you know, modern culture, really?
I mean, a brilliant question, and I certainly can't answer it with any expertise at all, if anyone can. But we know from the Old Testament and other documents that the ancients saw the future as something that was behind them, and the past as something that was in front of them. So the idea of, as you said, flowing forward is quite a new idea. And also the idea of kind of notching time on a kind of regular rhythm may also be quite new. So one of the objects I've brought to show you, if it's a good moment to have a look at that, is this new chart of history that was designed by John Priestley, who was a scientist and a radical. And he created a map of the whole history of the world as it was known then, in around 1750, 1760, that synchronises everything, that puts the whole history of humanity onto one page. And it gives you, suddenly it gives you this new sense that history is flowing forward like a river of time. Mm. And that we are heading for progress, because what he also showed was that there have been far more great men, largely men, in his map than there were in the ancient period, which means actually we're progressing. It was a visual model of how we're progressing. In from the, you know, for the ancient mind, or at least the medieval mind, the biblical mind, we're in decline since Adam. Adam had all the knowledge, being corrupted, and increasingly so until we get to Judgment Day and so on.
Priestley's pissing in the river of time.
You
can have that quote for the poster.
Thank you, that's brilliant.
Robert.
I'm going to, make you that poster. You can have it.
But this is quite an amazing way of looking at it. I mean, this almost looks like a cartographic thing. It looks like it maybe contains continents. You mentioned Renaissance art as an interesting but tricky way of gauging maybe what people in the 17th century were thinking about time and how it passed. What about other sort of artistic artifacts? Mm. I mean, how else has it been dealt with in the novel and in maybe in music and things like that?
Yeah, well, deal with music very quickly. Mm. And again, you know, being a kind of itinerant player, someone of no deep expertise but who slides between fields, I collect ideas, and one of them is around how when you're listening to a concerto or watching a dance performance, you are in the moment. It carries you with it. You're not waiting. I think it was Nietzsche who said something along the lines of, you're not waiting till the end of the performance to enjoy it. Mm. You're very much in the now, whereas there are other kinds of experience that we're kind of waiting for the end of it. We can't wait till we've sort of finished it, till we feel the sense of achievement.
That's a Proustian idea of like knowing the present, and never knowing you're in the present is a strange thing. And people can only seem to enjoy themselves in retrospect,
maybe.
To know that you've been, to be satisfied seems to be an easier thing to realise than that you were happy. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, the achievement of
you're sort of following my words slightly.
Yes, I am, and I'm.
But it is a tricky subject, isn't it? Because it is. It's kind of too fluid. It's like trying to hold hold some water in your hands, isn't it? It's kind of tough.
Time, yeah, incredibly tricky, and yet it's everywhere.
Do you have a sense? Do you ever see anything that shows this concept of lateness and time as a kind of oppressive, this idea of people being rushed, because in the modern era people seem to be rushed all the time and busy, and actually it is all relative. I mean, some people seem to be rushed continuously and then some people aren't, and it's a cultural phenomenon. Do you come across in your research anything that sort of shows the evolution of that?
I mean, the Tristram Shandy material is good again for that, because Tristram Shandy was written at a moment when middle-class houses were for the first time getting clocks. There's a hilarious moment where at Tristram Shandy's conception, his mum and dad are conceiving him, and his mother suddenly gets distracted because she thinks, oh, we haven't wound up the clock.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Have you not forgot to wind up the clock, is the line. So that's a book where it's resisting having to be synced up to someone else's clock. So you could say it's like Tristram Shandy is constantly late and tumbling over his story and never quite achieving the deadline he's set himself. He keeps losing the deadline. And there is a sense that he's resisting the fixity of the deadline. I mean, it's a great phrase, isn't it, deadline? Mm. It's like, as soon as you fix time, well, that's a dead thing, the deadline. It's a great phrase. But there are also a couple of other lovely examples, like in Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, where you have this really playful character and he is working in a factory, he's on the production line, and he can't quite stick to the kind of regimented beat, and he's a very playful soul, so he keeps sort of playing with the objects and falling out of time, and in the end he tumbles down the conveyor belt and into the machine and just becomes part of the cogs. And that, to me, represents quite a lot of how working life feels, you know, that relentless drive for productivity, to reach deadlines, to meet a date.
When we were researching the show at the Petrie, one phrase jumped out at me. It wasn't the other thing. It wasn't the thing we were talking about before. This was the relationship between Botox and time. And is this something to do with aging? Is this something to do with the desire to always be youthful?
No. I mean, obviously, Botox has got that in it. Now, this is a piece of research that I've only read about. I haven't looked at the primary material, and I'm slightly sceptical. But this is how I think it goes. So, we are embodied thinkers. We are bodily creatures. We think with our bodies as much as our brains. And when someone's experiencing some emotion or some distress that I'm trying to understand, say you were kind of feeling fear or sadness, and my attention was drawn to your emotions, I will be probably mimicking or mirroring them with my face in order to try and understand your experience. And in the process, my own internal sense of time tracking is distracted, and so time slows down for me. But apparently, if you stick a pen in your mouth, as some studies have shown apparently, if you stick a pen in your mouth and it freezes up your face, then you are less able to mirror those emotions. You understand someone else's emotions less. So in theory, time shouldn't slow down in the same way. And apparently there are some studies that show if you've had Botox, you have less ability to empathise with people.
That's
perhaps,
so good, isn't it? What a great
in
fact
theory,
that is.
But if you think about it, I've known people who've had facial strokes and I really haven't noticed any. In fact, if anything, we've become closer and understood each other better. So I think it's one of those sort of interesting studies that probably was played out on three people.
Yeah.
And who happened just to be quite lacking in empathy anyway.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there's something to do with that. Maybe there's a sort of solipsistic sense of kind of like self-preservation, which means you only really care about yourself if you have Botox anyway. Right?
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I can't judge, but it's an interesting thing that we can look
it's
into.
It's fascinating. I want to talk about this forever. Get it? I do. It's the most fascinating thing in the world. And there were all sorts of things I wanted to mention. Have you read that book, Einstein's Dreams?
No.
It's an amazing book. I'll have to find it and I'll tell you who wrote it, because it's amazing. And Time's Arrow, the Amos book, and that the HHH, that Laurent Binet book that came out last year, which is wonderful. Again, messes with this. These are all kind of Shandy-esque things which mess around with the idea of time as a storytelling device and all the rest of it. Anyway. That'll have to be next time. We've kind of run out of time.
Well, great.
Isn't
pleasure.
It a shame? Do you wear a watch?
No, naturally
Kathy
not.
Kathy Haynes doesn't wear a watch. Kathy, thank you so much for coming in on the Monocle Weekly. And when do these shows and talks start at Petrie Museum?
So we've got a talk on progress coming up on the 28th of Feb at Petrie with the wonderful philosopher Robert Roland Smith and the equally great astronomer Marek Kukula and the fabulous geneticist Mark Thomas. All of whom are going to kind of talk about why our mainstream models of what progress is are somehow flawed.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. It's fascinating stuff. And do you know what? At the end of edition 189 of the Monocle Weekly, we can safely say that time wasn't on our side. I could have talked about the time thing forever.
I know. She was... Kathy was welcome to stay for hours.
Didn't she have a nice voice too?
She did. She
I found was... her quite a soothing presence.
I did. She was wonderful. I mean, I feel like calling her on a weekly basis just to
I kinda wanna, yeah.
see what's happening in the collection.
I could just have a readout like her shopping list. Yeah. I'd be just happy. That's all I want forever.
That sounds slightly worrying.
Pint of milk, a dozen eggs. And who knows what breakfast cereal she... This is terrible. We've got to stop talking about poor Kathy like this.
No, we're big fans.
We are big fans. And that's a kind of unusual place. Not a lot of people go to London's Petrie Museum. It seems like a bit of a dark corner of the University College, right?
Yes, I went to University College and I never went there in all the years. But I think that maybe with someone like Kathy, they're really going to change gear a bit, because they're sort of getting the collection and sort of thinking about it and philosophizing and bringing in, you know, all these different ideas rather than just having, you know, Egyptology, which can put some people off.
She's going to bring in the crowds. Exactly.
Students.
What's happening next week? What's happening this week?
Turkey.
Turkey.
I'm going to Turkey.
I'm going to Amsterdam.
Nice.
I'll send you a postcard. That is it for 189th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and researched by Josh Fennett. Our studio manager and roving reporter was Jack Phillips. And we'll be back next week. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And for me, Sophie Grove.
Thanks for tuning in.